The Grade Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a grade cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the grade cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to The Great Cricketer. The summer in Australia has been and gone. The embers of the Australian summer dying in front of us, just like the Australian cricket team. My name is Ian Higgins. Thank you, as ever, for joining us. Today on the show, Paul Kennedy will be joining us in a moment's time, and of course, Trent Copeland. But I'm just telling you things you already know because you have the ability to read. I am joined by Sam Perry and Dave Edwards. Lads, welcome to the end of the summer.
Yeah, it's a summer thing, is it? Thanks, Higos. it feels a little bit like a bit deflating this week. Mm. Where's the controversy? You know, where's the deposing of captains and vice captains? Where's the sanctimony and schadenfreude from the UK? I personally just feel a little bit let down from all of this. Mm-hmm. There's just kind of really vanilla announcements of reviews that may or may not be in the best interest of Australian cricket. And apart from that, I don't really know what else is fun anymore.
Well, it's the calm after the storm, isn't it? So much happened. We were just refreshing our Twitter feeds insatiably. It just seemed like every minute there was a new story unfolding and another key member of the national side gone. And now we've just got to kind of wade through the admin around what we do now. And it's kind of shit. What do we do now?
my favourite thing about this summer just gone is the complete capitulation of this Australian
cricket in Australia in general.
It's the end of something. I'm not quite sure what it is, but it's like I didn't necessarily foresee the Australian cricket team coming home without a captain, a vice captain, a coach, two opening batsmen, the opening bowler having a leg fracture, and the all rounder needing to have ankle surgery. Mm. But you know, some big takeaways, because as Pez said a couple of weeks ago, G didn't come and spell well. So it's not all over. It's not all over for us. Where does one go from here?
I don't know. He goes, I really don't know, because you know, for like so many years on The Great Cricketer, we've just talked about the insatiable appetite we have for heads rolling, and then we got it. Like, we got it all in one. We got so many heads. And now we don't know what to do with it. It's like when I watch my dog chase a squirrel. It gets to the squirrel and doesn't know what to do once it gets there, but we got there. And it's like, shit, now the heads have rolled. What now? I mean, Clark back? Is that it? Can we talk about that? We know that he's poured water on it, but do we talk about it?
Yo, absolutely. Yes. Who cares how much water he's poured on this? We're going to talk about it in great detail, I hope. He goes, it sounded like you were about to interject there and set this up for us.
I can set it up for
please.
Us. I just feel like the biggest news since we last convened last Sunday evening, Monday morning listener time, the three players who were sanctioned have all accepted those sanctions. And it just felt like for me, like now the Australian public are just like, okay, that's the end of that story. Like, these guys' lives have been completely ruined by like the public reaction of like, oh, these blokes should never play again. What's a reverse swing? Mm. You know, that's like the people who have like affected like the moral outrage that we've had has just been affected by people, I think, who, you know, have possibly overreacted. But now, like, we've seen them all cry in front of camera and they've all accepted the sanctions. Now the public are just like, yeah, I'm okay with that now. I can sweep that aside. Whereas these guys actually have to keep on living their lives. And someone who also wants to keep living his past life, perhaps, is not friend of the show, Michael Clark. Well, he's not a friend of the show.
He's just not on our radar. We're not on his radar at all, unfortunately.
He doesn't know what this is, and why would he? But he, well, there's a story that came out in the Telegraph yesterday from Buzz Rothfield, and it's suggesting that Michael Clark is ready and available to help the Australian cricket team in whatever way he can.
Let's just react to it, even though he's said that it's probably not true. I mean, what a disgraceful idea. The first thing I thought when I heard it actually was like, hang on, isn't this whole thing about getting rid of arrogance in Australian cricket? Like, isn't it about us trying to step outside the elite prism where we actually can see that others think that we play really boorishly and we play with gracelessness? But no, this guy sort of finished 3 years ago with, you know, I think in his last series, he averaged like 16 and a high score of 38, and he couldn't walk.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Like, I mean, he hasn't been out of the game long enough. Like, it's still living memory for us what happened towards the end in both his career and, you know, the way he acted off on the field, you know, broken fucking arm, etc. You know, it's not like when a political figure like John Howard, you know, several years have passed now that we can look at him, you know, with rose-tinted glass and go, Howard, guns, what a saviour of Australia he was, and not remember that he was actually a bit of a fuckwit.
Let's burn everyone.
That's more of the inner city elites again speaking on this podcast. I like how, Pez, you said, like, you know, mate, he averaged about 16.13 and his high score was roughly 38, as if you haven't, you know, perused those statistics before. I just like the idea that he was probably one of the most divisive captains Australia's ever had, Michael Clarke. Like, not only did, like, you know, allegedly Shane Watson just hate him and he was the vice-captain, but, you know, he literally just, like, ended Simon Kadich's career because they had a bit of a bust-up, for instance, and, like... So I don't know if Michael Clarke is the answer, if he is, I'm not sure what the question is.
Yeah, he literally got rid of the best bloke in Australian cricket, and we're trying to come back to best blokes.
Oh, I think it's pretty obvious to me that this is actually Shane Warne trying to rule Australian cricket by proxy. Like, using Pup as this kind of, like, basically Warne is Steve Bannon, and Clarke is Trump. That's what he's doing. He's inserting this puppet in there, and Warren's going to pull the strings like he always should have. But now, you know, I'm not saying we're going to go alt-right, should I say, in Australian cricket. But, geez, maybe. I mean, today he came out and attacked the fake news media saying that this story wasn't true. Classic Trump.
He goes, can I just come back to what you were saying earlier about not, you know, us sort of getting blood, getting heads and not caring anymore? You know, we have a slightly differing view on the importance of public opinion with this, but you are right in the sense that, like, David Peaver, the chair of Cricket Australia, came out this week and announced the actual parameters around which this review would take place. And their parameters, you know, beg a lot of questions. Like, the Australian Cricketers Association have been isolated from the process. It's literally four blokes, you know, to report back into Cricket Australia when the question is about Cricket Australia itself. But we don't really care about that. It's like, hang on, are we interested in Australian cricket culture? No, we just wanted heads. Let's move on. What's happening in Supercoach?
Yeah, it's so true. I think like the winter break as well is like just coming at a great time because, you know, out of sight, out of mind. But yeah, it is basically an internal review into the culture of, like, the, and they're going to find, you know what? Well, I mean, Mark Waugh famously, you know, last week said, I don't see a problem. Yeah. And as Edo said in the show last week, basically confirming we've been ship blokes for ages.
Yeah.
And you know what? Mark Waugh's right.
Mark Waugh's always right. I actually have this written down here. He goes, for posterity, for the listeners, Mark Waugh said, I might be missing something, but I don't see this team as any different from previous eras. That quote is so perfect. You know, especially the prelude to it. I might be missing something, but...
Where did he start with that?
I like that he's slightly open to the idea that he may be missing something as well. Yeah. Like, that's the cognitive dissonance of Australian cricket in one line. Mark Waugh, more graceful than anybody.
I mean, you talk about how, you know, this comes at kind of a good time for Cricket Australia with the AFL and NRL season starting, but it's not really because, you know, you've got the broadcast rights fees coming up. Like, what's Michael Clarke going to do? Is he the saviour? Is he going to fucking go in there and get Cricket Australia $1 billion over 5 years in the media rights renewal? Like, what's he going to solve? I mean, let's just go back to him at a moment. If we just imagine that he does go into the team and straight into the setup, let's just say he's captaining the team against Pakistan. Why not? What happens? How does that play out?
I think it's good. I think it's great news for Matty Wade because he's probably getting another summer of Test cricket.
So who's his VC? So Payne's his VC.
I don't know. Warne may as well come back. We were talking about if we were to make a submission to this culture review, surely the front page would just be a picture of Matt Wade, like, just dropping a ball. So, I mean, was he not the symbol? Let's just burn everybody while this is happening. And there'd be a picture of Peter Neville behind him in the background just playing electric guitar. You know, and maybe Cowan reading a book or something.
I've actually never heard anyone ever say a bad word about Matt Wade. I could get the feeling he actually could be just a really nice guy, but, like, he's been told...
Everyone's just been told things, you know, Cam Bancroft was just told to use sandpaper. Everyone's just got shit blokes in their ears telling them to do dumb shit.
But we don't know who the bloke is, though.
That's all it is.
Yeah.
Blokes telling other blokes to do things they don't want to do, but they do it because they're scared. Australian masculinity.
So how much do Shane Warne and Michael Clarke just want to be captain coach of this team? I think they just like think about their time playing, like how good it was, and they just want to be mates again, just get around the boys again. You know, I feel like that's all they want. They want control. They want power.
Well, I predict that we're going to want them as the captain coach in a year or so when we're done with beta cricket. It kind of reminds me, and this is a long bow, but it reminds me of, you know, the TV show Captain Planet from many years ago as a kid. If you watched it, like there was an evil Captain Planet and they fought at the end, like in a massive boss versus bad boss battle. And like I see Warne and Clark as the bad Captain Planet and like Cowan and Kadich as the good Captain Planet. And like, who's going to win that battle in Australian cricket? The bad one, for sure.
I thought you were going to talk about Martin, who had the power of heart, and that's the most beta character on television that I can remember. Yeah. Everyone else was like earth, fire, wind, water, fire. Elements, and fucking heart. Yeah. There's no heart in Australian cricket. No place for Martin.
But who's Al Gore?
He goes... I don't know if... Are we going to keep going with this? Because there's another announcement... And a thank you that we have to issue on the Great Cricketer podcast, because we issued a call a few weeks ago for somebody to start a Great Cricketer Wikipedia page. Somebody has.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Somebody actually
did it. I
forgot
about that.
You know, because I don't scroll through Great Cricketer on Google much these days.
Don't have Google,
I did recently. It was on page 3 of the Google search, so I wasn't going deep or anything, but I saw a Great Cricketer Wikipedia page. And there were some definitions of sort of alpha, chop, rig, etc. There was a few things that weren't quite right, but I'm glad we've got it.
It's not an academic source.
I mean, you guys put this on the old WhatsApp thread, and I did see it, but I didn't actually. I sort of looked at it through one bleary eye. I didn't actually go. I've actually seen it. So, like, is there any definition? Is there any like description about who the fuck we are? Because like, I'm not sure there's much information out there, to be honest.
Our names are on there, and then it was just definitions of rig, circuit champ, etc.
I think there were three references. One was like a Dan Bredig article, maybe one was like a book review. So there's not enough references to really make this a credible source. We need more links, basically. We need more deep linking to articles about us.
Yeah, if people could add to it, that'd be great. I'm looking at it now. Our names are on there. The glossary has triple C, chop king, rig, and salad, which is good. Although rig is referred to as abdomen here. Is it that? I'm not sure that's quite right. Rig's a more of a holistic term, is it not? Just for the rig. Rig's just everything that you're setting up.
Yeah. He's a rig.
So it's just mere abdomen. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Chop king says the most prolific chopper at a club. I'm not sure you can use the word in the definition itself.
No, you can't.
It's about sexually intercourse.
I don't think we've ever used the word chopper either. Like, we've used chopsman.
Yeah.
Chop king.
Yeah. That would make choppery just like someone who wasn't a criminal. He just had a lot of sex with women.
Both true. I'm just reading the actual blurb about us. The Great Cricketer is a pen name of three Australian cricket writers, Sam Perry, Dave Edwards and Ian Higgins. They were friends who played grade cricket in Australia and began a Twitter account.
Where's the citing for that?
That'd be spot on, actually, in the past tense. Yeah. We're just colleagues now.
Yeah.
Who said anything about friends? Yeah, Jesus.
Yeah.
Well,
they
were
friends.
Just to briefly stop talking about ourselves for a moment, as much as I was enjoying that moment of self-indulgence, but... you know, the culture review that is going to happen in Australian cricket, which we won't know anything about because it's not going to get released to the public. I would like to highlight that if you want to know about Australian cricket culture, Tea and No Sympathy is out in all bookstores, and of course the first book, The Great Cricketer. I mean, like we literally wrote two books about the culture of men in Australia playing
in
cricket.
Australian cricket.
Like, we've already done it.
I don't know why they haven't
just
read
buy
it.
The books.
Has James Sutherland read our book or books? I don't think he even knew about us when we interviewed him, but he should bloody get amongst those books.
I thought that was going to be our submission to the review, just both books wrapped up in wrapping paper with Matt Wade on the front.
Just the draft manuscript. All right.
Sorry, Wadey.
Well, we've ticked off all the boxes there. Obviously, we're going to deep dive into the IPL every single week from here on in. I can't really watch cricket in India. I find it a bit of a struggle. And I was watching highlights this afternoon of the Mumbai Indians game, and I just thought that's a weird name to call a team. It's like calling a team the Sydney Australians.
Well, there goes that audience.
Highly lucrative too. Just bombed it.
Yep.
We can't get into India. All right. Well, more stuff coming up. What's up next? Paul Kennedy's up next, and then later, Trent Copeland.
Oh, look, I haven't changed my point of view on the matter. I said what I said a few years ago, and I guess at the moment he's obviously trying to sell a book. So it's amazing how more and more of the story comes out.
So are you two mates?
I think that's a bit of a stretch to say that we're mates.
Well, that's certainly what he's been saying.
Yeah, look, I think, as I said before, it's a bit of a stretch of the imagination, given that we've hardly spoken about since it all happened, and obviously haven't played since, you know, he took over as captain. But anyway, that's all old news now. So, as I said, I think it's more about him trying to promote his book through the summer.
Okay, lads, this guy that we're about to have on is a TV presenter on ABC Breakfast, normally does sport, occasionally hosts it. He's a journo, he's an author of a wonderful book called 15 Young Men, and most recently was presenter of ABC's investigation Caught Out, which detailed the events of South Africa and provides some deep context to it. He also had us on ABC Breakfast to promote our first book a couple of years ago. Didn't have us on for the second book, I should add. And so it's great to be able to return the favour on our own prestigious network. Paul Kennedy, PK, welcome to the Grey Cricketer Podcast.
Guys, thanks very much. Now, I didn't get a copy of your second book or a press release, which means that you didn't need me to boost book sales this time around.
Well, I actually just wanted to start by talking about our appearance on your show in 20... No, I don't. PK, tell us about the making of the Caught Out investigation. So for those who don't know, it detailed a bit of context behind what happened in South Africa with Smith and Warner and all of those guys. You spoke to so many people, you gathered a bunch of perspectives. What did you learn about Australian cricket attitudes or culture once you'd finished?
Yeah, well, we learned probably a fair few things we already knew, but looking at and comparing the different eras and generations, I thought was interesting for viewers, particularly those who might have been outraged by what happened in South Africa, but haven't watched every little bit along the way. And there were a lot of those people. So it was a pretty quick turnaround for the doco, and we did as much as we could in virtually just over a week. As soon as Smith and Bancroft had that press conference, we decided to make a show. And, yeah, we just tried to speak to as many people as we could about the behaviours of the cricket team and ask them, past players, a couple of commentators, Gideon Haig and Peter Lawler, who's over there, and Jim Maxwell, BC's own, and just sort of get a handle on the events over there. And then we sort of backtracked as well. One of the things, I once wrote a book about the Melbourne Storm, and a big part of that was how the salary cap thing came about all those years ago. And the best lesson I took from that investigation was that context is everything. So the more context you can give, a flashpoint like this, I think the better you're able to understand. And really what we learned was that, the Aussie cricketers have been gobbing off since probably the late 80s and 90s. They started verbally, whatever word you want to use, banter. And you guys know more about that than me, but in the next 20 years, they went up and down. Steve Waugh's mob talked about mental disintegration. They probably didn't cop that much flack, even though they had their scandals as well, but they were winning. And, and Kim Hughes probably said it best. He said that winning covers a lot of sins. And, the team that Smith took over was only going to win it 50% of the time anyway, and yet they were still trying to puff their chest out as much as previous teams. So, and then all of the things in South Africa, the de Kock sledging Warner, Warner giving him a big send-off, Rabada getting off on what seemed a farcical appeal and all the rest of it. But maybe a Steve Smith set it back best. It was a lack of leadership, but I reckon, you know, wasn't just Steve Smith's leadership.
So are you surprised at the fallout? I mean, not the fallout and that the team's crumbling, but the reaction back home has been just out of control. And now we've almost forgotten about it. You know, there's a few things happening now. We're kind of, the interest is waning a little bit because, you know, now we've got a review to get through, and we might get your take on that in a moment. But are you surprised at the way that the nation reacted to the saga?
I am a little bit because it was so furious. But then, you know, I've been in the media game for a long time now too, and it was one of those stories, one of those unusual stories where everyone had an opinion, and it didn't matter whether you're into Test cricket or not. The immediate reaction was savage against the team, and I think that was probably driven by, you know, a lot of people who have watched the behaviour, you know, probably on the nightly news, not necessarily sitting and watching a full day's play of Test cricket, but watching over the time, thinking, you know, these guys are carrying on like brats, seeing the odd highlight of Warner getting, you know, giving players send-offs. And I think, you know, the story gets bigger when everyone piles on. And so it wasn't just cricket people piling on, it was the entire population. So I think that's where it got a lot of momentum right at the start. John Buchanan was good on this, actually. He said back in the day when they had scandals through the war era, yes, there was a big reaction, but it wasn't, you know, immediate. It wasn't that second after, and it wasn't as long lasting because of social media wasn't around then. So that was his read on it, which I thought was a pretty good read. But then it also gets back to the fact that, you know, that they could, you know, Wardy could do something wrong, but he knew he'd take five for pretty soon after that. So this team didn't have that luxury, really.
Do you reckon we'll ever find out, you know, the full extent of what actually happened in Joburg there? I mean, like, because we sort of found out various events and various versions of events, you know, sort of straight after and then in the days afterwards, you know, do you ever think we'll find out exactly what went down and what sort of the feelings are towards, you know, certain players in the team, the certain structure of Australian cricket? Do you ever think we'll find out the full extent of this?
Yep, we'll definitely find out. One of those players in the room will speak, and it might even take more than one might speak openly about it. Mm. They all write books anyway, so we might have to wait till someone writes an honest book. But no, I can't believe that they'll all remain silent about it forever. And, you know, I know a lot of people are wondering, you know, whether the bowlers have got genuine disinterest in what happens to the ball. And so those are the questions that I heard a lot of people ask too, you know. You know, what do the bowlers know about the preparations for a reverse swing, if not any knowledge of sandpaper? So, I reckon it's still very early. And, you know, for once again, I just hear that Melbourne Storm or any other scandal, it's better years later. You get a clearer picture years later when all of the different personal, professional interests are not quite there. So we'll definitely find out more, and I want to know more, but we might have to wait until a few careers play out.
Like the JFK assassination. PK...
we'll eventually get to the end of that one, too.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's coming out soon. Anyway, you'd have a particularly privileged position, PK, in terms of understanding the mood of the nation. And, you know, occasionally these sporting events do throw up things that kind of create a deeper question about what our national identity is and who is part of, you know, all of these reactions. And I'm just looking at a piece that you did for the ABC where you sort of called for greater respect between teammates and opponents, and you also said something really interesting, and we joke about this a lot. You said that you predicted that blokey sport watchers who read this will bemoan my softness and declare sledging is part of the game. We joke about that kind of stuff all the time. How big do you think that element of Australia is where if you sort of call for a bit of respect, you're going to be called a cuck, basically?
I've written a little bit about this occasionally. Mainly, it's to do with junior sport. I'm pretty big on junior sport and participation rates failing, and I even set up a Facebook page called the Fun Coach Movement. I wrote about this for the ABC, and it was about how junior parents who volunteer as coaches can really ruin the experience for kids in lots of different ways, which, you know, I don't have to go into. But you know, I have a lot of people say to me, whenever I write about this, you know, you're a joke because
you know, kids need to be taught about life and loss. And, you know, they're talking about, one guy said, you know, if we don't keep score in junior sport, you know, what's my little boy going to learn? You know, he needs to be taught life lessons right now, you know, to prepare him for life. I said, how old's your kid? He said, oh, eight. Yeah, so some people are, they do savage you. And that's, yeah. And the other thing is, I was saying that you should really get away from criticism on the field. So sledging or banter, whatever you call. And once again, you guys know way more about this than I do. But I find it that blokiness really off-putting. Mm. And, you know, I find it ridiculous, actually. And I've done a lot of coaching too, and football clubs are the same. When you get a group of... When you get a good dynamic, a good coaching, progressive dynamic, you don't have blokes always hanging shit on each other. Mm. And but often I've been in coaching cultures, if you want to use that abused word, where blokes just are into each other the whole time, and I think it's funny. I find it, you know, and not very productive. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of resistance. But I find that if you're going to call out blokiness, it's probably the vocal minority that are going to have a go at you. Mm. And a lot of other people are thinking, yeah, that's what I was thinking. You know, I don't really like that either. So I don't know if it would make any difference in cricket. I'm, you know, only just a hit in the local fifths this year, and I haven't played since I was 19, so that's about 23 years. And so, you know, my experience in cricket really has just been a cricket lover and a cricket watcher over that time. So I haven't stood in slips and, you know, given it to a batsman over that time. Maybe it does cause wickets to fall. I don't know.
When we were chatting earlier this week, you said that you played fifth grade this season. You were champed by an umpire over 100 times in one game.
Massively.
I mean, we're talking about cultural problems, you know, at the grade level and the juniors. I mean, umpires, officials, the custodians of the game. Can you just explain how that happens?
Well, you guys probably aren't familiar with this, but at that grade of cricket, it's the opposition who umpire. And one of the blokes in the 50s from any 50s from the other team, and I'm bowling off spin, and I cannot turn the ball to save myself. And the first time I bowled since I was 14, but every time, you know, I'd give him my hat, I got champed. And it lasted for
how many overs you bowled?
Four over spell. not many. Got tonked a bit and got off. But in that time, he was champing me every time. Probably eight times an over. Thanks, champ. And it was disgraceful. And the 15-year-old kids that we've got on our team, they were onto it too. So I got ridiculed by them as well. They've all read your book. See, that's the other thing with this blokey culture. You guys have written about it as satire. It is for anyone to behave in a way that you've made fun of would be the equivalent in my industry of carrying on like Mike Moore or Ron Burgundy. You know, people have explained that that's ridiculous behaviour.
Yeah.
And it still goes on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. And Faf Duplessis with his towel. I mean, that's a whole other ballgame.
I think that's a great place to wrap it up, PK. The wonderful bringing together or collusion of media and Ron Burgundy and Anchorman quotes in the great cricketer. It's a great place to finish.
Is there
it.
Any advice for if I get to someone who gets furiously champed at that low level?
Live advice.
Yourself in a towel and faff. We always just tell people to quit cricket. That's usually our response to these kind of situations.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you say that because I think I've done that.
Paul Kennedy, an absolute pleasure. You can catch Paul on ABC TV. I think he's covering the Commonwealth Games. Wonderful couple of books out as well. And, if you haven't seen it yet, check out Caught Out, his investigation into what happened in South Africa and where it actually comes from, because it's pretty deep-seated. Cheers, PK.
Thanks, guys. And I hope someone's making a movie about your books and your stories as we speak. I can't wait to go and watch it.
It's that time again. It's that time to talk about our friends at Budgie Smuggler. That's right. They make swimwear to protect and cover your parts. They've stuck with us, boys, throughout this whole South Africa series. A business born in the backyard of Australia. I don't know. Has anyone got an angle on this? Budgiesmuggler.com.au. I remember the actual website of it. Sales are up. What are we saying?
Well, do you reckon, like, you know, the whole, I mean, the highlight of the summer, obviously, was Faf du Plessis coming out to greet David Warner and Quinton de Kock in a towel. Do you reckon he was nude under there, or do you reckon he was packing some budgie smugglers underneath that towel? Thoughts?
I'd love to know what was on under that towel. He goes, I mean, I've said that to you off air. I'm saying it to you again on air in front of 15,000 listeners. I think he probably was. I think you have to. I don't think it's a requirement in wearing budgie smugglers to chub, but it doesn't hurt.
You know how we've said previously about how, you know, like, it's important that we get around, you know, small business. Like, how do you actually physically, like, envisage, you know, like, us, like, getting, like, is people just, like, actually getting around, like,
in a circle,
is like a little semicircle formation?
Yeah. It's a circle formation. Well, there's three of us, then it's a triangular formation. We're just getting around small business. And clapping and
kind of dancing around in a circle around it.
Shouting, lads, 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 small business, win.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, this is really our equivalent of Under the Southern Cross that the Aussies sing when they win a test match, except that we decided that we thought that they should sing Champion by Grinspoon. But this is our way of doing that for Budgie Smuggler, which you can find at budgiesmuggler.com.au. You can make your own custom smugglers. So if you've got a design idea, these guys will facilitate it. You're in the UK as well, budgiesmuggler.com.au.
We grade cricketers work hard. Everything has to be hard at all times. Work hard. Circuit hard. Just be hard. Never smart. Always hard.
Lads, this one's been in the works for a long time. It should have happened a long time ago, to be honest, because this is right up our alley. Let's do some numbers here. 80 first-class matches, 297 first-class wickets. A best of 8 for 92, which he took on debut for New South Wales. In fact, in that debut season, he finished with 35 victims at 17.5 second decimal place, in only 5 matches. 10 wickets in an innings over 3 times. Famously debuted for Australia against Sri Lanka in 2011, taking the wicket of Tilakaratne Dilshan in his first over. He was just anointed New South Wales Sheffield Shield Player of the Year and runner-up in a coveted Steve Waugh medal. I'm, of course, talking about Trent Copeland. G'day, Copes. Welcome to The Grade Cricketer.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. It has been a while, but I'm an avid listener and love your work, so it's good to be here.
I like that a couple of guests that are coming on, boys, is just starting to say, look, it's been a little while since you've asked me.
Sort of, harassed me on social
it's
media.
It's just a little bit of it. Yeah, that's right.
Get me on sooner. Thanks,
I like it. It's good. Copes, you're a St George stalwart, which is a famous club. Of course, the club of, you know, Bradman, Linwell, O'Reilly, and Stephen Green. What does grade cricket mean to you?
One thing I don't like that's happening more and more regularly is being called a veteran and a stalwart and things like this. I still tell everyone that I'm 28 years old and I'm as youthful as ever. But the one thing you alluded to there is guys like Stephen Green, but also the legends that come with the St George District Cricket Club. And I'm bloody honoured to call myself the first grade captain of that club. I first came to the club when I was 18, just finished school in Bathurst in country New South Wales, moved down as a third grade wicketkeeper, opening the batting. And my first experience playing grade cricket was with a legend named Warwick Hayes. And he famously doesn't talk to you in between overs. So I'm a young kid from the country, out of his depth, opening the batting. I faced my first over. I'm like, wow, thank God I'm through that. I look up halfway down the wicket and my teammate's standing on his bat down the other end. And that was my initiation into grade cricket, but it's come a long way from there. And, I've played over 10 years at the club now. And, as anyone who's played grade cricket knows, it's a family and it's bloody good fun turning up every week. And I try my best to be there whenever I possibly can.
So, Copes, I mean, you did just describe as sort of your journey through grade cricket, and you rightfully said that you were once a wicketkeeper. And I believe that the story is that you broke your finger in a third grade game wicketkeeping. I think it might have even been against Gordon. And then from there, you opened the bowling for Australia in Test Match Cricket. So,
What's going on?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that was it. There wasn't anything in between. It was the next day. I was just, I've had enough of this keeping business. And, I actually was playing Premier League hockey in Sydney in the off-season.
Right.
And then keeping as well. I'd broken or dislocated pretty much all 10 of my fingers. And it was just starting to get a bit ridiculous. So I decided, and there was the other thing was I had Nathan Pillen in first grade, who was also the New South Wales keeper at the time, Kevin Pillay, a long-standing veteran of the club at St George in second grade. And in those days, you really, if you're a keeper, you basically could score 1,000 runs and, you know, catch everything, but the guy above you just wouldn't move. So I decided to take my gloves off and have a crack at the 6 batting spots in the grade above me. The one thing I had on my side that most keepers don't is that I'm 6'5". Most keepers who have a bit of a bowling streak in them like to try, but then don't quite have the bounce that I have.
Copes, do you... This is so bizarre. I like that, like, you decided, look, I can't make it as a keeper, so I'm going to try something else. I'll try batting. This is before you even find out that you're going to open the bowling for Australia. Is there a part of you that thinks, what the hell was I doing for the first 10 years of my career when I started at, you know, age 10 in cricket? Or you sort of talk to dad or mum and go, why did you make me keep?
Well, no, it was certainly when I was playing in Bathurst, playing junior cricket in the morning and then playing men's cricket in the afternoon, my avenue to getting into men's cricket as quickly as possible and all the New South Wales sort of rep stuff was to be a keeper. You know, have that extra string to your bow. So that was where it stemmed from. But, yeah, I wish I'd bloody realised sooner. Could have saved myself a whole lot of trouble. Back problems, knee problems, it's just not good.
So do you think that, like, a lot of keepers, that they just become keepers just out of necessity, just to survive in a club setup, you know, just to, I guess, ensure their relevance? That was what you were doing, essentially, but then you found out that you were good at bowling really, you know, fast and accurately and good areas.
Yeah, well,
I don't even know if that's a question, but I'm just so taken aback by the fact that you started as a keeper and then decided to bowl and now
areas.
You became an Australian representative.
Well, and constantly getting called cymbals and dropping them for fun and all of those sort of things did play a role, given that I wasn't catching everything. It's been a strange journey. And one that I'm pretty bloody thankful for. And, you know, you alluded to a few stats when we first started. The debut for New South Wales was an unbelievable day to call, you know, the SCG my home, to have Simon Cadditch be my captain in that game. And to take the wickets, it was only bloody downhill from there, unfortunately.
Well, Copes, I've also previously been a third-grade wicketkeeper. Are you suggesting that if I just start rolling out some meds in the nets that I can still make it? I'm 31.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. I mean, okay. I should be, if there is any role model out there for you, it should be me. I'll tell you what, though, there is some other keepers around the country that do roll them out bloody well. Matty Wade took 3 for this year.
Matt Wade, yeah.
There's numerous other guys that terrorise guys in the nets, but never to be seen on match day. But, thankfully I've had the chance to do it.
You've also been very gracious allowing 3 blokes off the internet and make sort of slight fun of your career when you've played for Australia. Let's fast forward a little bit, for your time at Cricket New South Wales. I mean, to me, Cricket New South Wales is the ultimate alpha institution. You know, more than any other state, it tries to produce, you know, powerful, aggressive cricketers. I've got a two-pronged question. It's kind of said that your elevation to New South Wales cricket was done through dominating grade cricket rather than through sort of the academy process per se. So my question is really, you know, how were you received by these New South Wales Cricket Academy stars when you joined them? And how good was it to wear your Blues kit at grade training?
Oh, yeah. And you know, turn up after coming back from an away trip at Hurstville Oval on a Thursday afternoon where everyone else is training in your Blues travel gear. Yeah, it was fun. I have had my whole career, and I'm sure numerous guys who've spoken on this podcast, but also that you've experienced personally in the grade cricket fraternity, I guess. I'm not the, you know, star young quick. I've never been the guy who used to bash it around and hit boundaries when I was a batter in junior pathways. So I guess I've known from a really young age that I had to get through in performances. It was never going to be guys going, wow, this kid could be anything. You know, like I'm sure the first scout that saw Paddy Dangerfield play footy, I'm sure, you know, they knew straight away. Pat Cummins, when he first played his tests, you know, I was on that tour running the drinks and, you know, everyone knew he was going to be a star. So in my sense, I'm not any of those. and I had to basically bang the door down. And a little sort of story about my first ball in Sheffield Shield cricket. I'm absolutely positive Simon Kadich standing at first slip next to Dan Smith, the keeper, Steve Smith at second slip, Phil Hughes at third, Davey Warner at gully, and I'm sure you get the gist. When my first ball bounced twice before the keeper, thought to themselves, my goodness, who is this joker? thankfully, it improved from there. But it's been a little bit like that along the way. And any debutant, all you want is to feel like you belong. And that is pretty difficult when you don't have the superstar attributes along the way. But it's a good lesson that backing yourself in and perseverance generally pays off.
Yeah, so Copes, let's just forward to the, you know, the national representation, your test debut. I mean, obviously there's a lot of talk at the moment about the culture in the Australian team, and we're not going to go into your thoughts on that now, but just when you debuted and when you made your debut there, just can you run us through a little bit about, you know, being accepted into the group and, you know, the days and weeks leading up to that debut? How was it?
Yeah, it was a really amazing time, and something that I'm very fortunate and will look back on very fondly, no doubt, when I finished playing cricket. Nathan Lyon and I had just played a Australia A tour in Zimbabwe. On our way back, we were told that we were going to tour to Sri Lanka, and that was amazing in itself, and I still remember that like it was yesterday. But the one thing that stands out is the guys like Ricky Ponting, Ryan Harris, Mike Hussey, you know, a lot of these guys, Mitchell Johnson, just being so welcoming from the get-go on that tour. Like, you know, you've been teammates for years, and no doubt that's why they were legends and still are legends of Australian cricket. But they had that such a profound impact on me and Nathan in particular, stepping into what was our first test match. The night before that game, when we had been told that we were going to debut, we had a little note slipped under our door by Justin Langer to talk about, you know, what it meant to be part of this baggy green club and what it meant to many of the cricketers that had gone before us and all of those things. And that was a handwritten letter. That it was just that little special touch, you know, going into that first day that made you feel like you're in an elite club, which you are. When you put that baggy green on your melon. A couple of, I guess, things that stand out on the day when I was presented my baggy green from Dougie Walters, who was there on a trip and doing, you know, support tour.
To be there.
He was late, turned up on a tuk-tuk, and it was a surreal experience. But that was pretty special. And then having Nathan and I debut in the same game, I took a wicket on my second ball. Dilshan hit my first ball, mind you, wide half volley, smacked it through the covers for four. And our bowling meeting was, don't give him any width. And I'm thinking to myself, all right, no worries. And then next minute, bang. And thankfully, the next one, we had a short cover in, and Ricky Ponting's got the best hands in the business, and it was still wide, still full, and he smacked it. But thankfully, Ricky held on to it. But the, you know, that settled me down. Nathan Lyon took a wicket on his first ball, outdid me. I've since been dropped. He's now got 300 test wickets, and what could it be?
Copes, obviously you guys have just wrapped up the Sheffield Shield season just the other night, having a little New South Wales presentation, new sort of awards nights, and obviously it's the end of the careers of Ed Cowan and Doug Bollinger. It's got to be sad to see those guys go.
Oh yeah, so much so. And hearing the speeches the other night, the awards night, hearing both of those guys sort of talk to us in their last days of spending, you know, Sheffield Shield Day in the field, or you know, talk to us after that about what they were going to miss. That really broke me emotionally. seeing what cricket has meant to these guys over a long time, you know, I don't cry all that often other than in bad movies, as my wife will definitely tell you. But I think those were two times where these guys, we spend so much time out on cricket fields and in pre-season, you know, blood, sweat and tears. And, you know, a lot of guys put a lot of effort in, and particularly someone like Dougie, wholehearted, and, you know, everyone loves him across the country just for the guy he was. He wasn't anyone different to the public that he was internally. And I bloody love being able to open the bowling with him for 8 or 9 years for New South Wales. And he certainly made my life very easy. At the other end, because everyone was shit scared of his pace, and it helped me out the other end. And then Ed, you know, Ed, a very different type of character, very measured, very comfortable with his, in his own skin. But what a team man, you know, behind the scenes. When he came back from Tasmania, I had never played with Ed before that, so it was only since he came back that I was able to sort of see what he was really like on and off the field. And he's, what a player. I mean, you know, just scored 10,000 first-class runs, 1,000 test runs, probably under club for his capabilities. But two special guys that we're going to have a very difficult time replacing in that New South Wales side, and turning around what was a pretty disappointing season for us.
Cope, so I feel like I'm a little bit rattled at the moment because we don't normally talk to really well-spoken Australian internationals who are earnest and understand the significance of what they've done. I mean, you've got us completely rattled. So in order to try and change that, because we don't want to be deep about anything as men, we're going to go into the throwdown section. We ask you silly questions, and you may or may not want to answer them. So I'll kick it off just to completely switch the idea of New South Wales cricket. Copes, it's said when New South Wales cricket is strong, Australian cricket is strong. You guys finished second last in the Shield with a weird score of 34.37 points and fourth in the weird-sounding JLT Cup. Is it the fault of New South Wales that the national side is now ruined?
Yeah, completely. I mean, it's all our fault. The baggy greens that are in the paper bags when you get your baggy blue got lost this year. We've had a really tough time of it, and you know, maybe we could get you guys in to do a cultural review of the place.
Yes, more reviews. Business is good for TGC.
Copes, just want to talk about the strength of the St George Cricket Club bowling attack. Just for our listeners who won't know, perhaps, Danny McLaughlin was a tearaway quick who played some state cricket for Western Australia, but he ended up playing a second grade game actually against me because the bowling attack of first grade at St George that day was Copeland, Hazelwood, and Moses Henriques. What did Danny McLaughlin say when he was dropped to second grade?
Probably the same thing he said to you while you were batting, and that was, "You are effing kidding me." it's been a bit different with some of the characters that we've had in our lineups over the years. Danny at the top of the list. No doubt anyone who's following your social media has had an experience with Dean McLaughlin. That's pretty good one, thankfully. he hasn't tried to bounce me too often, and we get along pretty well, so I'll come out of that one nicely.
Copes, we obviously talked about how you dominated at grade level, but before that, you're a Bathurst product. I just want to get your thoughts in a sentence or two on the circuit there and your disappointment in having to leave it for greener pastures.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a great circuit. I mean, comparable to King's Cross, and I think, you know, up there with the likes of Bungalow 8 on a Friday night.
So, Bungalow 8, still
in 2003.
Yeah. The water down at the riverbank the Ox Hotel in the middle of the town. No, it's awful, mate. Yeah, and I certainly was a little bit sheltered in my kit when I moved to Sydney. It was awful. Arguably still is awful. My chat had to rapidly improve so that I didn't get sledged on the Thursday night circuit post-training.
Shoes, mate.
Copes, a two-pronged question. How important is it to bowl 140s in Australia, and are you better than Chad Sayers?
well, seemingly very bloody important, the way things have gone the last little while. Yeah, none of us have got a look in. But, no, in all seriousness, geez, it was refreshing seeing Chaddy get a game. It gives the rest of us who bowl, I won't say the pace, but under 140, a chance. And I'm no comment whether I'm better than Chad Sayers.
Does it reflect on one's masculinity, the amount of kilometres per hour that he bowls?
Definitely. Well, certainly in other people's eyes.
But what about the bowler himself? When you're bowling and, you know, it comes out at 120, you know, whatever, how does that make you feel?
Certainly less of a man than most.
Great that I'm a pro cricketer.
Particularly the environments I am surrounded by. I am a lesser human being than pretty much everyone else around myself.
Right, there's the promo line.
That's like the show.
Australian cricket.
Perhaps you dismissed Mahela J. Wardner, as I'm sure you probably think about every single day in the shower, in the aforementioned Sri Lanka tour, via a diving catch to Michael Clarke at second slip. Michael Clarke then celebrated towards the team, saying, "Mahela, 100%, 100% I caught that, clear as." To which J. Wardner replied, "Just relax, chill, mate. I do walk, you know. When was the last time you heard a bigger lie?"
I am more than happy to stand on here and listen to you guys bring up jokes if it's preluded by my greatest achievements. So, yeah. I mean, we're going to talk about me nicking off Mahela, and that's funny to everyone out there. I will sit here for hours on end. I haven't heard a bigger lie, other than the fact that probably... that later in that test series, I was batting and Mahela was standing at first slip. They had run out of their reviews. I tried to play a reverse sweep off Rangana Harath. I don't know why I was trying to reverse sweep it, given I don't know which end of the bat to hold these days. But it smacked into the middle of my glove, which I didn't feel at the time. But watching the replay back and hearing Mahela call me a cheat from slip, it was... Yeah, it was a little bit of a testing time at that point, and maybe I was telling a lie standing on my bat, saying I'm not going anywhere after being given not out.
And Coach, I hope you are taking these jokes as three people who are sort of punching up at the people who are just the 140s devotees, you know, and like on that note, I just wonder... Although he was kind of dismissing your teammates in Smith and Warner and all these guys in South Africa, is there any part of you who watches Vernon Philander destroy them that just thinks, yeah, take that. This is for us. This is for the slower guys. Is there any part of you? Take that, 140s club.
When you say, is there any part of me, there is every single part of me. I mean, I don't like it necessarily that it happens to Australia so often, but... Yeah, I think more people out there need to realise that wickets are wickets. Mm. And it's a lot about control and how you move the ball. And I'm sure you guys know that much better than most. But it's about time someone like Vern came out and changed the mould. Not only taking wickets, but I reckon he's racked off the skin folds check and a lot of the fitness stuff along the way. So good on him.
Copes, it's been great talking to you on The Great Cricketer. Sorry it's taken so long to get you on. Loved hearing what you've said about, you know, what it really means to play cricket and that you don't have to conform to the 140s club and the skin folds club to make it. You're a living, breathing example of that. Thanks for being so gracious taking our jokes about it as well. It's been great having you on.
Cheers, boys. Thanks very much.
Harry Broad, good morning. You've been reading The Great Cricketer.
But most of the book has taken up with proving he isn't good enough. Locker room language is rife and sexual immaturity is rampant. Having sexual relations is called burgling a chop. I'm very disappointed. I thought this should be a great book.
Well, it's that time. It's Ask TGC time. And due to popular demand, we have welcomed back a clinical psychologist onto this part of the segment because, well, let's face it, we need it. I'm, of course, talking about Dr. Tim Sharp, Chief Happiness Officer, or Dr. Happy, I should say, organize. Let me just go through the numbers, Dr. Happy. I know you don't like this. You want to do it more humbly, but we always go through the numbers. We go through the major elements of people's CV. Organizational consultant and speaker presenter, executive coach, clinical psychologist, adjunct professor, UTS Business School and RMIT School of Health Sciences. It's probably not even the full picture, is it? You're going to be too humble to say the other academic qualifications you have.
Nothing that's as interesting as opening batsman for the under 16 A's.
That's not my resume.
Okay, cool. We've got you on because, yeah, like I said, there's a lot of questions in here that require clinical help. He goes, you're the reader. Let's do it.
I'll read the questions then. All right, here we go, lads. Josh Mel starts us off this week using the hashtag RCGC. He says, "G'day, boys. Feeling very confused about my life right now. I understand a world of alphadom. It's enjoyable, unlike cricket. It's straightforward, unlike my ability to drive, and clear-cut, unlike my rig. Up until now, I've injected the office with what can only be described as low-level primary school hazing slash bullying, kicking people's desk chairs lever so they slide down, drawing high school quality penises in people's notebooks on as many pages as possible, and changing people's computer desktop photos to low-income single dad cars doing burnouts. But what happens when a beta world comes into effect as a result of the pain era? How should I carry myself at work? How do I become the ultimate beta? Thanks, guys. Appreciate the help. I'm at a loss what to do, Josh. P.S. To get on the front foot, I don't play grade cricket. I barely even play park cricket. I'm a genuine 12th man. Does this increase my beta standing? P.S. This is the first time I've ever slid into someone's DMs and couldn't be happier that it's you guys. Love your work."
Right.
Well,
so it's kind of like when a new prime minister comes in a sense. They bring their principles and their values, and businesses try and kind of hook on. So what Josh is saying is that we're in a beta era now, Dr. Happy. We were in the alpha era, and now that we're in the beta era, he's not sure how to behave because he thinks that we all have to be beta males now that Tim Payne is captain. What do you say to Josh's question?
Oh, look, firstly, Josh, I'd say be very, very careful about the overuse of parentheses.
Alfred,
grab way too many qualifications in your question, and that's certainly not an alpha quality, I don't think. But I do think, look, I've given a lot of serious consideration, and I honestly think the beta is the new alpha. I think Tim has a... There's a hashtag in there too, actually.
That's good.
The new alphabet. Yeah. I think Tim Payne's a great example of how the new man, the modern man, can be nice. He can shake hands with the opposition before they walk on the field, but he can still go on, continue batting with a broken thumb. So on a slightly more serious note, I think this is something I'm very interested in, and that's the redefinition of manhood and masculinity. And at the risk of getting too serious, I think this is a really important opportunity for us all to consider what the new alpha male will be going into the next decade or two.
Love it.
Mitch Buckley says, using the hashtag RCGC, "Do you agree with Cricket Australia's stance that grade cricket is community service and therefore a punishment for crime?"
Yes.
No, grade cricket is the highest level of amateur cricket in the world. It should be treated as such.
Dr. Happy?
Well, look, I think there's a fine line between pleasure and pain, as they say, and one man's punishment for community service.
All right. Asked and answered. James Westgate said, "It's a tough world being a bowler. Big bats, flat pitches, small ground, and apparently no ball tampering allowed. At least away from home, where you can't control the cameras. Adding insult to injury, why is there no bowling equivalent of a triple C? A bowler's deemed to be beaters straight up. Surely a Michelle Pfeiffer and a double C should count. Hashtag ask TGC." So he's basically saying here that only batsmen can achieve the triple C because that's a century circuit chop for those playing at home, grade cricketer bingo. So what is the equivalent of a triple C for a bowler?
I'm just amazed there's so much interest in triple C. Doesn't it just go to show that slogans really work? And that's why it will never happen for a bowler.
It's like a throwaway line in the first book.
Yeah.
Like, and then it's just really being latched onto the triple C.
It's like, but stop the base.
It's like this. Really slogans. Runs are everything in cricket. Yeah. I mean, runs are the foundation of cricket. And, you know, I actually started as a bowler but then became a batting all-rounder because I knew that, you know, I would rather get a 50 than a 5 for any day of the week. While I'm at it, how lame is it when bowlers salute the grandstand after taking a 5 for? I never really understood that. Did McGrath start that?
I don't know.
I think he did. Yeah, I think he did. You say that the Triple C is a throwaway line from the first book. I distinctly remember us having like an afternoon long conversation about what the Triple C should be, and like we initially discussed like he has to end it with the Triple C, but we finished the first book differently. Obviously, spoilers, despite the book being now 3 years old. I distinctly remember us like discussing like what the Triple C should actually be. Like it took us hours. Don't give me throwaway line, David.
Oh no, it was a throwaway line earlier in the book, and then we obviously closed with it and spent 4,000 words dissecting it in detail.
Dr. Happy, I just want to ask you: are bowlers inherently inferior to batsmen?
Oh, well, I think Dave made a pretty good point. If you choose to be a bowler, then you've got to, there are certain consequences with that. And that's life. As James had in his question, life's tough. So, you know, suck it up.
All right, Alex Patmore says, hashtag AskTGC, dear grade cricketer, I'm a 30-year-old cricketer getting ready for the new season in the Northern Hemisphere. And so, as has been the case for the past 18-odd years, I've just experienced my annual pre-season cricket dream. You're probably familiar with the common batting anxiety nightmare. A wicket falls in your next in and can't find or simply get your gear on whilst the whole ground waits for you. As a wicketkeeper, I've also had a keeping anxiety dream whereby I actually find myself on the pitch standing back to the opening bowler with no gloves on and the ball disappears through my sometimes translucent hands to the boundary for four byes.
Translucent.
But this year was different. Instead of the aforementioned stress dreams, I dreamt I was receiving throwdowns in a net facility that had mirrors on all sides, and I was timing the nuts off of everything. And most importantly, I looked fucking good from every angle. So my question to TGC is this. Should I A, look forward to this season with renewed optimism and confidence given the apparent conquering of my subconscious, or B, retire immediately, as isn't cricket a 90% mental game? So in a sense, by achieving this cricketing nirvana, I've basically completed cricket. Cheers, Alex. Yes, since the dream, I played our first practice game and scored 14 from 30 balls, getting dropped twice. It was fucking yuck. PPS, I'm currently living in Japan.
That's one of the best questions. Yeah. Oh, this has got to go straight to Dr. Happy, doesn't it? This is about subconscious and dreams. I mean, run us through it.
Well, I'm trying to get my head around cricket in Japan to begin with. That's a bit of a head spin. But, look, there's so much pathology in that one question. There's dream analysis. There's a hall of mirrors. This guy, I think, needs some serious help, with all due respect, Alex Patmore. But I suppose there's kind of two approaches within psychology that dreams mean everything or the dreams mean nothing. So we can take our pick here, and if they do mean a lot, well, again, Alex, you're in serious trouble. If they mean nothing, just keep living the dream.
Yeah, that's right. Live the dream. Hallway of mirrors. Nets.
Dave Edwards, ever had a dream where you're surrounded by mirrors?
It's just every day. It's not a dream. I've just recently renovated. No, it's Dr. Happy. I mean, isn't this what like psychologists would call a breakthrough? Like, I mean, he's completed cricket. He's had the ultimate dream. He's realised it. I think he just has to quit cricket because it's not going to get any better. Certainly not in Japan, where the wickets are shit.
I would have thought the wickets would be perfectly manicured in Japan. Sure, there would be some great pictures there. But it does remind me a bit of a. I don't know if any of you guys were Seinfeld fans, but I do remember watching a Seinfeld episode many, many years ago where George told a joke in a team meeting, I think, when it's one of those rare opportunities when he actually had a job. And he told a joke and everyone laughed, but then the meeting went on and 10 minutes later, I think everyone forgot about it. And he went and talked to Jerry, and Jerry, as the comedian, said, look, mate, if you hit that perfect thing, if you get the audience on side, you make the best gag, you just walk off and leave. So, the next team meeting, he walks in and he makes a joke first up and walks out 3 seconds later. So, yeah, look, I think you're right. If this guy's his peak, I think he should just leave and retire. Not going to get any better.
All right, Alex, that's professional advice free on this great cricketer podcast, so you're welcome. Joe Bell, hashtag RCGC, says, what, in your opinions, is the most alpha shot in cricket? Apologies if it's been asked before, but I have listened since the very beginning and can't recall this vital debate being aired. Joe actually did then provide a 4,000-word essay about some of the shots that he suggested, but I just thought I'd abbreviate this question by, what, in your opinions, is the most alpha shot in cricket?
Hmm. Straight drive for six.
I think it has to be certainly something off the front foot, or maybe like a front foot pull shot off the opening bowler that goes over mid on. Like, it doesn't go square; it's really straight, possibly over the bowler's head. Just whatever it is, it has to be off the front dog, and you have to take the ball early, which shows you that speed doesn't concern you, and whack it really far and flat.
Preferably, if the ball like goes past the bowler's head and they put their hands up to protect their head, it obviously doesn't hit it. And the umpires as well, it's like saying, you've tried to hit me with this cannon and now I've hit it back harder at you and faster, and now you're protecting yourself. One bounce, four off six, doesn't really matter. If it could smash into the boundary as well and make a really big thud, I think that would be preferred.
Yeah, smashing the sign or the fence on the full, like some kind of corrugated iron, just the sound of that, you know, permeating around the ground is also important. So it's not just about the shot itself, it's the after effects.
Yeah, I agree with that, Dave, and I'll pursue that final thought. And that I think often if you hit a big six, you have to basically turn away before, like, I don't actually, something that comes to mind, one of the most alpha shots I've ever seen, I think it was against India, and Brad Haddin is batting at the SCG, and he's come to the wicket, and I think Kohli, like, stood next to him and just started clapping. So a ball hadn't been bowled to Brad Haddin just yet. He was fresh to the crease, and Kohli didn't say a word, but he just, like, stood at the popping crease and just started clapping at Brad Haddin. I forget, it might have been Ishant Sharma or another of the Indian medium pacers was bowling. It's a full ball, and he just, like, bombs it first ball down the ground for six, and he hits it and then just, like, walks away straight away. He doesn't even watch it off the bat. And so that's probably the most alpha shot I've ever seen. So, and but it, all of that is the after effect. Like, he didn't even need to see it. Like, he knew that he got it, you know?
He knew, yeah.
I mean, there's a reason why in the nets at training you deliberately try and skew balls to go out of the net, isn't there? Because you just want to watch it fly. Like, there might be the really wide balls, arc, but you still just try and hit it straight because you just want to watch the ball go and you want people to scramble out of the way and hopefully collect one of their shins, right? Is there a psychological element to this, Dr. Happy? Do you have a view?
Oh, there's many. There's always many psychological elements. You know. But I have very mixed feelings about this because on the one hand, as I said a few weeks ago, you know, alphas don't compete, so any shot is a real alpha. Any shot's a shot for him. But I've got a bit of a soft spot for either the edge straight through the slips cordon at catching height that no one touches, even the cut that misses both the pads and the stumps, goes for four, because that's got to be the total, you know, fuck you to the bowlers. it's pretty hard.
I like it.
That might be something
subversive
about
alpha.
Beta is the new alpha. All right, Bav slid into the Twitter DMs and he uses the hashtag RCGC. He says, dear grade cricketer. That's twice we've been referred to as dear grade cricketer. But he says, I've been a tragic of the game since my primary school days, plying away at a measly village level for a career average of about 10. The great cricketer preaches that the purpose of playing cricket is to earn our father's love. However, my very European, very non-cricketing father could not care less about the game. In fact, he has not even been to a game, not even to show up for 5 minutes at a final, as he has never cared for the game. My father is an intelligent man and a dedicated fisherman who has enjoyed his Saturdays on the ocean and making more catches than I've ever taken. My question is, why have I wasted the past 26 of my years of my life playing? Is he really my father?
So well written. I don't know. I mean, we're all clueless around our relationships with our fathers and cricket, aren't we? I mean, that's why we're here. This whole thing is group therapy. We've said that many times before. So I don't know why you've wasted that time. I don't know if it's because he doesn't care about cricket. It may be something to do with you as well, Bav. You know, we're all wondering about that kind of stuff, aren't we?
I mean, cricket is such like a dad-driven sport. It's literally dad-driven. Like, your dad drives you all around the state to go to games. So it's there from the start of your career, you know, from juniors all the way through. So maybe Dr. Happy has a take. I'm not sure if you're familiar with you know, other amateur athletes who've come to you for advice, maybe, you know, do they have the same kind of concerns about their relationship with their father that cricketers do, or is this exclusive to cricket?
Look, I think it's probably a bit broader, but cricket does have a particular, I mean, it takes a particular sort of parent that'll sit out in the sun for, you know, up to 8 hours a day or whatever it's going to be. So there's a particular type of relationship there. I think our friend Bev here definitely should paternity test. That would at least answer some of the questions. But I also I read this question earlier. I read this question and it brought me to tears. I mean, really, Bev, I feel for you, but this is a sad, sad set of affairs. I was lucky enough, I have a dad that came to almost every, or pretty much every game when he could. That didn't necessarily strengthen our relationship because, you know, when I threw the bat at him a few times, it caused a few problems. But there's got to be a way that you can bring the fishing together. Maybe you can find a pitch close to the coast or, I don't know, maybe an oval that has a river running through it or something. But surely there's got to be a solution to this.
Dr. Happy, should Bev raise this with his father?
Mm. Oh, without a doubt, preferably over a couple of beers and a few bit of fried fish and chips, I think. Mm. But, you know, we've got to face these issues. And you know, there'll be a day, as sad as it is to say, but there'll be a day when Dad won't be around and it'd be a pity not to have had this conversation before he goes. We need to have these conversations with our dads. We need to have them with our sons. And that's, look, I guess on a semi-serious note, that's an important issue. We've got to connect up and down and with all the men in our lives, I suppose. And Bev, it's time to have that chat.
Love it.
Mm.
And they're the psychological issues that we've brought to you this week from our audience. Dr. Happy, thank you so much for joining us and helping us again with issues of fatherhood, manhood, toxic masculinity, alphadom, and whatnot. And we leave learning that Beecher is the new alpha. I think you've probably summed up Australia's culture review in one line.
Thanks for having me.
And so comes the end of the Great Cricketer podcast series for the sudden summer of 2017-2018. We've done a bucket load of shows. Some of the guests we've had on have been absolutely ridiculously amazing, and even some of the smaller guests have been provided light-hearted, humorous moments whilst you're walking your dog. This is going to be us done for at least a little while. We are in discussions with each other if we're going to do a UK podcast series. We hope that we are, but that's up in the air. But of course, it doesn't really matter because you just like turn your, you refresh your podcast feeds at some point and then the podcast will turn up or it won't. Of course, you can follow us on social media. You already do anyway. Tea and No Sympathy is out in bookstores in the UK on June 7. That's exciting for us and we hope it's a little bit exciting for you. If you haven't bought the books yet, fucking buy the books, man. Unnecessarily aggressive. My name is Ian Higgins. I will speak to you again shortly. I'm signing off on behalf of Sam Perry and Dave Edwards. We'll see you soon.